Miller. It's 3:20 p.m. on January 29th. With us today, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, who is Vice Chair, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Tito, and my chair, or myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones, or you'll be buying us something healthy, I think. Not sure what. We have two items on the calendar today. The first is House Bill 159, Healthcare Retainer, and the second is a update on the from the Division of Insurance on normal activities and recent activities, which are probably not normal. I hope we don't have too many of these. But anyway, we first heard House Bill 159 at the tail end of the last session. With us today we have Ken Truitt representing the sponsor, and please join us at the table, Ken. The members have a draft blank CS in their packets. I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS as the working document.
Mr. Chair, I move CSHB 159-29-LS0256-H as the working document.
Seeing no opposition, we'll be adopting the CS. Welcome back, Ken, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and give us a walkthrough.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Truitt, and I am staff for Representative Keller, who's the sponsor for the bill. And we'll give you a brief walkthrough, since it was we had a very quick committee hearing, and we really appreciated the opportunity at the end of the session in April last year to get to present this to you. And I can go over the changes that are in the draft, the blank CS, for you as well. Real briefly, this bill seeks to amend the insurance code by creating an exemption in the insurance code and create space for what we call direct primary care practice groups for physicians and other healthcare providers. The way that it works, physicians would contract directly with patients, and that contract without this exemption would fall within the definition of insurance. So thus, this bill seeks to create space for that to occur without there being the regulatory oversight that you have with an insurance product, because we believe that this is really more gives room for a relationship between the physician and their patients. The benefits that we see from this legislation is that it can reduce the costs of healthcare and also provide greater access to care. What you'll find as you look at physician, the demographic for physicians right now, one in three physicians in practice today are primary care providers, and there is a bubble of primary physicians in general who are looking at retiring or staying in the practice of medicine. And there's not a concurrent bubble of providers coming out of medical school to take their place. One in six recent graduates from medical school are primary care physicians by their specialty designation. So currently we're looking at one in three, but what's coming out of medical school is one in every six. So we're seeing a potential of a real decrease of primary care providers, and we're hopeful that this bill can help entice providers who might be thinking, should I retire or maybe I'll stay practicing. We can convince that cohort to stay. If you real quickly, the walk through the bill. If I direct your attention to the W version, the version that we introduce, line 4 on page 1, that is the exemption itself from the insurance code, Title 2103021, that seeks to introduce a new subsection K. Paragraph 1 underneath that is really kind of the bulk, the meat of the bill, which basically sets out the contract relationship between the physician and the patient. What follows in 2 through 9, going on to page 2, are the specific requirements that the written contract has to have, the elements that need to be in there. And finally, starting on page 2, or line 10 of page 2, a new subsection L, gives you some definitions, defines what healthcare is, who the healthcare providers are, and then routine healthcare services, And that's the phrase within the bill that this language uses to describe the direct primary care relationship, routine health care services. And I would direct your attention to line 24, the subparagraph there, C, which is the definition of laboratory services. That's important because the blank CS that you have does away with the Roman numeral 2, lowercase 2, the second half of the definition of laboratory services. So what the CS, how the CS differs then from the bill that we introduced, the first half of the definition of laboratory services is the extent of what is in the blank CS that we that you all just adopted as a working document. And the reason that we proposed this committee substitute, we were approached by physicians who were saying, if you look at what sub 2 says, it provides that for a physician or a physician group that sends labs out to a laboratory that the physician's group does not have a relationship with, the physician's group will cover the cost of those laboratory services. So we were approached by some physicians who were generally in favor of this bill, who said that, gosh, if you're going to make us cover every lab service, you're going to make us eat the cost, we're not going to be able to make this pencil out. Part of what was attractive about this legislation was this is modeled very closely on the Michigan law statute that passed last year, and it provides a nice balance of freedom for the physicians and the patients without what we considered a lot of undue regulatory oversight by the specific division of insurance for that state, but still offered some parameters or side rails, if you will, on how the relationship needs to be consummated in a contract. So we thought it was a nice balance between enough regulation without having too much, creating enough space to allow a market to really develop for this type of these types of services. So that's the overview, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And I believe we do have somebody who's standing by to testify, but whatever your pleasure is, Mr. Chairman.
I think first of all, we'll throw some questions to you, Representative Ledoux.
Okay.
So I was reading the background here, and incidentally, I think I like this bill.
Thank you.
But it was explaining the difference between concierge medicine and this bill, and they actually sounded the same to me. I don't understand the difference.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Through the chair, concierge care, I think, is more closely identified with celebrity care. I mean, the concierge practice, as that developed, you would pay a celebrity physician multiple thousands of dollars through the term of your contractual relationship. This seeks to, and in addition to that, it was an expected part of that relationship to where you essentially paid the physician or the physician group for access. And then the physician group, in addition to that, would also bill insurance as a regular part of how the practice worked. This is a little bit different in that you're not paying just for the access. The fee that you're paying monthly under this arrangement forms the backbone of the commerce and or what the expense is for you as the patient. The bill points out on page 2, line 8, paragraph 9, that the physician group is not allowed to bill insurance for anything that goes on in that relationship. But if there is something that occurs that is a patient might have an insurance product that would cover that, the patient is allowed to seek reimbursement from the insurance, whatever insurance they might have.
Follow.
So why wouldn't you want to have, for example, a lower membership fee and then let the physician bill the insurance company? Because I'm not sure how, under this scenario, how the individual bills the insurance company, because there's not going to be any paperwork or those billing codes or anything. I don't anticipate. So how would you ever, if you're a patient, how are you? And I know some doctors already say, like I had a doctor, and she said, you're going to be responsible for sending in the forms to the insurance company. But she gave me the billing codes and everything, so all I had to do was take an insurance form and send it off. How would this work under here so that the patient actually could get reimbursed by the insurance company?
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think that's a sublime observation and a really great question. And I wish I had the exact answer in black and white. This particular provision that you're asking about was brand new. The first time that it emerged was in 2015. So the short answer is I think that's between the physician and the patient, and then the patient and the insurance company. The physician can work with the patient to get whatever documentation that the insurance company might need. In practice, I can't tell you how often that exact scenario gets played out, how many patients are seeking reimbursement for any of the services that might occur.
Ken, might it be that the patient is buying access that's pretty much prepaid, and with the concierge, you're buying house calls, and you're buying it with you're paying more, number one, and number two, in addition to having access, you're having basically somebody that's on call, and you have less patients. The concierge don't have the volume of patients that the this plan does. This is the way I understand it.
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good observation, yes.
Representative Kudo, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ken, so I'm trying to figure out how this would actually apply in practice. And it seems as though if you've got a small practice or maybe a medium-sized practice and you sign up many individuals, you're amortizing their care over these monthly fees, which is kind of a mini insurance. But I guess what I'm concerned about is if an individual in that plan, well, two concerns. One, an individual in that plan develops a serious condition, are they covered or would they be adequately covered? And is there any assurance that the small practice can handle that kind of an excessive cost? And then second, I'm a little concerned that as a small insurer, that a clinic may be able to not accept individuals for care in order to keep their risk low, which means they're taking basically healthy people out of a regular insurance market, which is going to put more pressure on the regular insurance market for people with more complicated health care issues.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Kudo. Through the chair, again, terrific observations, and I would answer that question in two ways. First of all, both of those situations that you describe exist right now, even without this being in law. Those circumstances present themselves. So that's already an existing concern with the existing regulatory framework for the practice of medicine and for the regulation of insurance. And again, the second thing I would say is that I don't know that in this state, and I understand who's presenting after this, that a regular insurance market exists for private individuals right now. I think that's a big concern for everybody. What this practice can do, the way that it typically works in other states, is that it works in conjunction with high-deductible catastrophic insurance products, and this is viewed as a secondary insurance. It qualifies as a secondary insurance product under the Affordable Care Act. So it really seeks to fill the gap, a gap that exists in other states, and I think that certainly exists today right now in this state.
Thank you.
On that point, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
If I may add to that, Ken, through the chair, Representative Kudo, I was concerned about that too, that taking the cream of the crop patients. As I spoke with some physicians in the state that are interested in this model, they said that would be a very boring practice. And physicians like to keep their skills up, and most good physicians would want a variety of patients. And so that isn't the likelihood, because they like the challenge, perhaps, and the reward of working with somebody with chronic diabetes, for instance. The second thing is, as far as your concern about the person may have develop a serious condition that would not be able to be handled by that physician or covered under that monthly fee, that all of the specific care and what that physician can provide has to be in the contract. And so if they require specialty care, for instance, that wouldn't be covered. So if they develop cancer and they would need surgery or something beyond what the primary care provider, that's all spelled out in the contract. So the physician would be obligated to provide the services that are spelled out in the contract. So just wanted to add that to Ken's response.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused about what the patient receives. And, for example, if you look at line 18 on page 2, defining routine healthcare services, it includes screening, assessment, diagnosis. How can those things be done if you're restricting, and I'd have to look at the change here that you identified in the CS. Are you restricting, you said you are, I think, some of the lab work that could be part of the monthly fee, right? Some would not be eligible under the monthly fee.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, not exactly. I mean, you're an attorney, and you understand that as you look at line 18, the word includes is typically interpreted under the statutory rules of construction, includes but is not limited to. Mm-hmm. So by removing two out of the CS, that isn't prohibiting that from ever being a part of the contract. Because the way that that's going to be interpreted is what follows in 3, A, B, and C, those are the things that absolutely must be covered under routine healthcare services. The word includes doesn't prohibit other things from being included in the agreement that you might have. So if you had a big enough physician practice group that could absorb the costs for lab fees for labs that they don't have any association with, mm-hmm. that could be included within the contract. That's how we, as the sponsor and responsible for the draft, interpret that change.
Okay. And a follow-up. If there had to be a later referral and there was no coding or paperwork, it strikes me that the insurance company, if one had secondary insurance, they'd say, we don't first of all, you wouldn't be admitted. I mean, for example, the Alaska Spine Institute would say, I assume, Mr. Josephson, you're paying cash because we didn't get anything coded from your direct primary care provider because he doesn't do paperwork, and so it's as if we've never met you. Isn't that what would happen?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'll take my stab at that. We also, like, so we have a physician online who's involved in the ins and outs of billing, and this is how, this is my understanding of how that might work. Nothing in this bill exempts any provider from the record-keeping responsibilities that they have under the Physician Practice Act. Under the Physician Practice Act, keeping adequate records is going to be part of the standard of care. And a way that a bill works, the physician rarely is involved in actually preparing the bill that goes out from their practice. That gets handled on the back end, if you will, by the administrative staff who have to know the ins and outs of the different insurance codes, the E&M codes, the ICD-9 codes, all the codes everybody lives by in the healthcare world. Those staff people take a look at what the physician has marked down in the patient chart. They've got a bill sheet then that they hand code. They put in the codes that would then go to whatever payer you're trying to get paid from, Medicaid, Medicare, or your insurance provider. So what the record keeping that the physician or the physician's assistant is going to be doing is going to be the same. That is a standard of practice. I've been involved in the management of healthcare services, hospital-based systems, and when we've had actual disciplinary actions against physicians, it's because they didn't keep adequate records. That's not going to change. This doesn't exempt any physician from those practice requirements.
Okay. I mean, just as a follow-up, I mean, for example, at line 19, where it says that the physician in this bill would have to provide treatment, it doesn't say there's any limitation to the treatment. So I could see that these contracts between physician and patient would get pretty complicated. I mean, you'd have to have a pretty long contract that a patient sat down, preferably with an attorney, and read through to really understand. Treatment is an awfully broad word.
Through the chair, Representative Joseph Sim, I think that's probably true. As a member of the bar, I'm a member of the Health Law Committee, and just in December, the Health Law Committee had a continuing education presentation on just these types of care, just these types of practice groups, and how to draft contracts for physicians to cover just those types of things. So I mean, I guess the point of that is saying that the local Alaska bar is already ramping up for these types of agreements and how to make sure that just those types of concerns that you're raising, that they're prepared for.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Representative Ledoux.
A couple of things, if you could give me a little bit of leeway.
Sure.
I guess I don't see any way that the patient could bill the insurer under this, because they're actually paying for they're paying for their access. They're paying for the routine, everyday treatment. I think it would be virtually impossible and probably not even appropriate. I mean, for example, let's say somebody's they come in one day for a cold, and then they come in the next day for a stomach ache or something. For the physician or the physician's administrative assistant to write them a billing code for those two things, because they could come in all the time under this, and they've paid for everything. They've paid for everything under one big lump sum. So, whereas in the concierge subset of this, they pay something for the access, and whether it's the physician comes to your home, which might be the Shangri-La version, or you go to the physician, which might be the Target version. But then you're paying for every specific treatment. Under that scenario, I can see how either side could bill, either the patient or the doctor could bill that to the insurance company. But I guess I don't see that under yours, where you're paying for everything. And there's no distinction.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think if I understand your question, I think you would be paying everything under the contractual agreement. And even the contractual agreement could list out a set menu, if you will, of options that are provided. And then there could be additional a la carte items that may, even under the contract, have specific other charges to go with them beyond. And there may even be in that same menu items that say, this is just really not it. We don't consider these services that you might need within this fee, and you're welcome to seek reimbursement for them after you pay us. You're welcome to seek reimbursement from an insurance carrier if you have insurance, and we'll assist you with the paperwork for that.
Just a couple of follow-ups. Is there going to be somebody here from either the Division of Insurance or from perhaps the insurance industry who might be able to tell me?
Next,
okay. Can I go on to my next sure. question or observation? So this doesn't really work as really comprehensive insurance unless it's coupled with another insurance policy, because there's no insurance against, a broken bone. There's no insurance against cancer. There's no insurance against heart disease. There's only insurance not insurance, because you're not calling it insurance. There's only a contract as far as those routine things. So I actually could see it working pretty decently as long as somebody has another type of insurance, as you were saying, the catastrophic insurance. So then my next question would be, what sort of deductibles can you get under the catastrophic insurance? Because I knew somebody once who was trying to get like a $25,000 deductible because they were young and they had a very nice income and they didn't think that they were going to get very sick. And they couldn't find an insurance company to give them a deductible of $25,000. That here in Alaska, the biggest deductible you could get was, I think it was $5,000 or $10,000. So I'd like to hear about deductibles.
Can you get together with the director after the meeting? And I think she can answer that. What I'm going to try to do is get as much of this done so we can have her give us an update on everything that's going on right now. We're not going to move the bill today.
Okay.
There's one minor kink that came up this afternoon, and the sponsor of the bill and I and the director were not able to get together to sort our way through it, but I don't think it's not a big deal, but I'd like to send the bill out clean.
Okay.
With that, are there any further questions for Ken, Representative Hughes?
I just have a comment, Mr. Chair. I think as this is a relatively new business model, I heard about the first type of thing being rolled out in the state of Washington maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, but as it just, the statute in Michigan was just 2015, my guess, and maybe the Division of Insurance might be able to mention it, but I would think when you have new business models like this, that sometimes it takes a while for things to catch up, but I'm guessing that the insurance industry might be responsive and be able to work with this model if they haven't yet. It's just my guess. If it is something that is well received in the medical marketplace and it's a savings to people like it, I think there might be something developed along those lines. I think it's a little early, perhaps. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kito.
Thank you. Question back on that section 3, subsection 3, starting at line 18, page 2, where it talks about under B and C, the dispensing of medical supplies, prescription drugs, and laboratory work, both being provided at the provider's facility. Mm-hmm. So if those items are not available at the facility, then the recipient would need to be going to a regular pharmacy and not paying an insured rate, so paying a full rate. So if somebody, for instance, has hepatitis and the new drug at $700 a pill is the treatment, then they go out and they're actually experiencing that cost if it's not available within their thing. So I could see situations, many, in our current healthcare system where an individual could end up paying significantly more for health care while trying to save money because the providers may be every provider, but there might be some that just provide very little and force the individual to go outside to pay cash for all of their other items. So I'm a little concerned about that. I think the idea seems like a good fill-the-gap idea, but there are implementation issues that I do have some concerns about.
Thank you, Representative Kito, through the chair. I mean, and again, I think that that circumstance that you just described exists right now, even without this practice model in the marketplace. If you're somebody who can only afford a catastrophic insurance plan, it may be, it would depend on how that plan is read, whether the new hepatitis drug qualifies as catastrophic, you know, meeting the terms of that insurance product. But that situation that you're describing right now exists right now, and this represents an attempt to try and alleviate that and meet some of that need. Would this meet fill all of the gap? I don't know. The first model for this appeared in 2006, so we've had about 10 years of it, and I haven't heard that being a particular problem with this type of practice model.
Sure. Well, as a separate question, actually, I guess one of the questions that I have is what the target market individual is for a plan like this?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Keto, it's going to be somebody, an individual who's not covered by another, they don't work for a large employer, they perhaps don't work for government, they might be a sole proprietor of their own business, they're required under the Affordable Care Act to have an insurance product or carry or be penalized on their taxes. That's the market, if you will, for this. The person, your small business owner who's struggling to meet that insurance requirement that's currently in law.
Well, with this policy, without anything else, without a catastrophic insurance policy, would this by itself meet the requirements of the Obamacare mandate?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not exactly sure on that, and I can get back to you with an answer on that.
Appreciate that.
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Actually, I think I can answer that because it says, and I'd be interested to hear from Ms. Wing-Hire, but it says that either party can terminate the agreement by giving written notice. Well, that just wouldn't qualify. I mean, that's just not consistent with the Affordable Care Act.
To the chair, typically where it in other states, it works in conjunction with a catastrophic insurance plan.
Thanks a lot, Ken. Lori, do you want to come up and answer a few of the questions? Representative Hughes.
I just want to respond to Representative Josephson, because until that's terminated, it's still active. And that same thing could happen where somebody has insurance through an employer and their job is terminated and the insurance stops and then they don't qualify. So I just, you know, while it's active, whether it can be terminated or not, insurance can also. And then all of a sudden, person is within the federal law or outside the federal law.
Thanks again, Ken. Lori, please join us. And after Lori, we have one person online, so we will open up public testimony after Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For
Welcome
the record,
back.
My name is Lori Wing-Hire, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. First, I want to thank Representative Keller and his team for bringing this bill forward. There's no doubt that at this point, healthcare needs every innovative idea that we can think of to bring affordable healthcare to Alaskans and throughout the nation. And this is something that we have seen be brought forward in other states. That being said, we have talked to Representative Keller about our concerns with the bill. We don't see this as a secondary insurance product. We do see it as access to medical care of physicians' clinics that you may not be able to get into rapidly. There are clinics in Anchorage and Fairbanks that we have talked to, that we have received calls from, that have said, based on current fee schedules or such, we cannot make money. We are not able to keep afloat. And something like this would allow us to keep our current patient volume and continue to provide the level of care that we are. Some of it has to do with individuals who you're asked about an age group or a demographic when you get to Medicare, and all of a sudden you get a notice that your physician will not see you. well, that's an age where you might be able to get the physician to say, well, if I had a retainer agreement, then it would be, you would pay whatever it is, $1,000 a year, whatever the contract is, then you would, they would accept your Medicare, but you would be buying access to that by this monthly or annual fee. We do have some concerns, and Representative Ledoux, yours was one. We do not see how it can be billed if there is not something totally outside of the contract that you can have a bill generated and then turn around and bill your ACA qualified health plan or your grandfathered plan for that matter. This is not the way this is not an insurance product, and a bill just cannot be generated to then bill the insurance company. So we do have a concern with that part of the bill and how it would look. I mean, we are in obviously in a, somewhat of a crisis right now and are looking to keep costs down. And so we are concerned with being able to bill for things that we would think would be included within the contract itself between you and the provider under this bill. We looked very hard at other models, and is it an insurance product or is it not? There's no doubt that as written, this is not a qualified ACA health plan. But could it go outside and we could say it is not an insurance product? We think we could, but we would like to see it with some constraints. The state of Washington asks that they be registered with it's a very simple two-page registration. And it allows for consumers then to register complaints. And then it asks that we report back to the legislature of complaints received. It's a simple process. We think we could do it so that you know if these are being successful within the state or not. I am available for questions on that, but those were our...
I see at least two. Representative Ledoux followed by Representative Hughes.
So one of the problems when people reach the Medicare age is that even if they want to pay out of pocket to see their primary care physician, my understanding is that if their primary care physician is seeing anybody else who is on Medicare, they can't say to the new person that walks into the office or the old patient who, you know, started out as a young patient and is now an old patient, they can't say, well, I'll take you, but Medicare is only paying $100 and I need $150 for this procedure. And the person might very well say, okay, fine, I'll pay the $50 extra dollars in the cash. But the Medicare doctor, if he's taking anybody else through Medicare, can't take that. So before we begin my questioning, am I right about that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I am certainly not an expert in Medicare billing, but I do know that we have received calls because people think that insurance is, or Medicare is insurance. They see it as that, even though it's we don't always have the answers. And so when they call, what we can tell them is, because it's not an insurance product we regulate, that we can't tell them if the doctor can cease to see them or if they can not take the payment cash, the difference between what Medicare is paying and what the fee schedule is.
All right. Well, assuming that I am correct, I mean, what I wanted to know, and I guess I need to talk to somebody who might know this Medicare answer, is I'd like to know whether a doctor who has any other Medicare patients might be able to enter into one of these agreements with somebody who is 65 or over who has Medicare, and then so they get the whatever it is, $1,000 a month for the access, and then they bill Medicare for. Yeah. Are you following me?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe I am, and from the providers that we have heard from that see patients that are of a Medicare age or rapidly approaching. That is what they have asked for in this type of an agreement, to be able to continue to see those patients that are about to or are of a Medicare age.
I think what the director is saying is because it's not under her purview, she can't.
Right. So I think
she's probably the wrong person to ask.
Is there going to be somebody online or ever that I might be able to ask?
We're holding it open so we can we can find somebody for you. Representative Hughes?
I have two things, and one of them is actually very much a follow-up to that. Would there be anything to prevent a physician from having within his patient load a group that he has these direct patient primary care contracts with, for instance, seniors on Medicare, but then also having part of his patient load being the traditional patients that are billing insurance that would work with, you know, through your division? Could he have that all within one practice? Is there anything that would prevent that?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I would not see why that would be prevented, why a physician could not see Medicare patients and others. I'm pretty sure my primary care physician does.
But it follow up?
Yeah.
But it would be basically two different arrangements. One would be the traditional billing and insurance and all that, and one would be these contracts. So you don't see anything that would prevent that kind of a dual practice with under one roof by one physician?
Through the chair again, no. But there would need nothing that would stop me, perhaps with a high deductible, under an ACA individual plan from entering into an agreement such as this for a different reason. If I had a $10,000 deductible, such as Representative Ledoux was talking about earlier, there are different demographics that would benefit from a retainer agreement.
Okay, thank you. And then I had a second question that kind of turns the corner a little bit on a different topic. You mentioned something about a two-page registration that so that you could have a little bit of oversight and a place for patients to come and you'd be able to report back to the legislature. Don't we have a state medical board for that reason? And already our Alaskans, if they have a concern, they can contact the state medical board. Wouldn't we be duplicating that if you were to set up a registration process?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there is a state medical board. I don't know if it would be duplicating the process. Again, we were trying to look at when they call because of an insurance product or something that looks similar to insurance, and I was looking at what Washington did with their retainer agreement bill, and that's how they dealt with it, was through the Division of Insurance and not through a licensing board.
Okay, thank you.
You know, I'm just speculating, but I would have to guess in the larger population centers, the next step will probably be for the same group to put in standalone surgery centers where they can do day surgery and then offer it on the same basis or even build it into the original rate. But I would suspect that would be the next step, along with their own diagnostic centers that would handle it. But I think what we're going to do is see it grow, but that'll only be on the, you need a population to support that, but I think that will probably be the direction we see it going, and I mean, I hope it does, quite frankly, because it would offer an alternative. Any further questions for Lori before we open it up?
Well, just one thing, and to get Ms. Wingenheuer's reaction to it. It strikes me that, there may be some carve-out here that could work and benefit the world in some way, but it strikes me that there's going to be a lot of sort of disputes, physician-patient disputes, because generally, if I go see a GP, he's going to carry things to the nth degree. That is, if I have a sinus problem, he's going to treat that as best he can until they reach a point where their education stops and other expertise is needed. Then I go to the other person. They're going to do the same thing. They're going to take it all the way. It's like taking the football to the end zone, right? Here, you're moving a few yards, and then the doctor might say, geez, I've been with you for an hour, and I could see starting to get into dispute about what these terms mean. What does it mean to say, I've treated you? What does it mean to say, I've diagnosed you, or I've assessed you? I don't know.
Ken has an answer for that. Ken, do you want to come back up for a minute? Or do you want to take that one as well, Laurie?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I can tell you that it's discussions we've had with Representative Keller's office as to can the clinic sustain the treatment diagnosis. At what point does it go from what I would consider primary care to taking someone through a full-blown cancer diagnosis, for instance? And our conclusion has been that it depends on how the contract is written, not so much the statute, and that it would be defined in the contract itself as to what the physician would, the extent of the treatment you would receive under the contract you signed with your physician.
Sam, did you still have a question? Nope. Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Woodley.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair. It's basically in response to Representative Josephson. If there are an increase of disputes due to this new arrangement, I would think, coming from your background and field and profession, that that would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Actually, we're going to be here all week if we're debating amongst the members. Ken, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Josephson, and to answer your question directly, the state of Washington was the second state to pass a law for this type of arrangement. I would say they have amongst the more restrictive of the states in terms of how these practices are dealt with. And given that, in 2014, from the latest published data, that's the most recent data that's available from the state of Washington, from their Division of Insurance, they report that there are 8,558 patients within the state of Washington who are members of these types of organizations. And the types of disputes, the types of complaints that you're talking about, the number of complaints that have been received by the Division of Insurance was exactly zero for the fiscal year 2014. So while that might be something that we could think of in an academic type of debate setting, the reality from the most recently available data is that that's not borne out in the practice of these types of relationships.
Representative Ledoux.
So is there any data on the number of people who are seeing specialists as opposed to general practitioners, and has that risen since Washington initiated this law? Because while it may not lead necessarily to disputes, I could actually see it leading to an incentive for the primary care physician to send somebody off to a specialist earlier than they may have previously done so, although that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if, you know, it might be kind of iffy, but, you know, if I was seeing somebody for something and he wasn't quite sure of himself anymore, I'd want the referral to a specialist.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, what I have heard of these agreements is that you seek primary care sooner to get the referral sooner so that you are getting proper medical treatment on a more timely basis.
Thank you.
Thanks again, and I think with that, let's hear from a doctor. I'm going to open up public testimony, and then Lori will be back up on a different topic. Doug Nicholson, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for calling in today, and we appreciate your patience. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention.
Thank you. My name is Doug Nicholson. I'm a 64-year-old family practice DO, currently working out in Unalaska at the Lillik Family Health Center.
Please continue.
I was first found out about this bill through Mr. Romero, who then put me to Mr. Truitt. And when I explained that the current model of practice is generally a volume-based model, where you're expected to see a certain amount of people to generate a certain amount of revenue. In so doing, that's how you cover your costs. In a direct pay care model, where the contracting is direct with you. And a lot of these DPC clinics have limited amount of people so that they allow almost direct access, either same day or next day. They can see them over Skype, over a HIPAA-compliant video screen, and don't need face-to-face, which a lot of visits don't require. As a 64-year-old, as if I look to continue doing a volume-based practice, I don't know how long I could do that versus being in a relationship model where you have a more confined group of patients to see that you become like family to. This is something I could do for 10 or 15 years. So you brought up a lot of different questions. And I visited a direct pay care model in Wichita, Kansas, called Atlas MD, and spoke with other people. And these models have worked very well for these people. Some of these people can choose to see people that they don't charge because they don't have an obligation to charge the same fee for a Medicare patient as you would someone else. So there's more flexibility. It balances the interests. When I was in a critical care hospital in Nebraska, we were incentivized to admit people to the hospital, the very place that you want to keep people out of. Whereas in a direct pay care model, you might charge them $5 more than what Quest or one of the LabCorp organizations charges you for a CBC. If you go to a hospital, it'll be $50. If they charge the doctor, it'll be $5, and the doctor might add a $5 draw fee, so you can get that same test for $10. So this model seems to work best in people that have maybe a $5,000 to $10,000 deductible with the catastrophic health care. I don't think it's designed to work well with people that don't have any insurance at all. It's also designed, as Ken says, to allow small employers who want to incentivize them to maybe pay for part of this direct pay care fee as a way to help cover this. Most people do never hit their catastrophic fees, and most of the health care that people use are at the primary care level. And so where I'm at, we charge, we're in the 90th some percentile, and if you come and spend 10 or 15 minutes with me, you come out, if you're an established patient, with over a $300 bill. There's nothing I do, because I'm not doing surgery here, that costs $300. Whereas in a model like this, it gives you a true ability to charge for what you're actually doing, so that they don't see you in the grocery store and go, that's the doctor that saw me for 15 minutes, and then I ended up with a bill that's disproportionate to the amount of time you spent. If you choose to dispense medications, a guy there in Wichita, he can get a common blood pressure pill for a penny a pill. It's called lisinopril, one of the common blood pressure medicines. That's cheaper. 30 cents is a month's worth of pills, which is cheaper than what you can get at Walmart. And so the advantages go on and on. He can get reduced costs if you paid cash for your CT or your MRI, because he could contract with an imaging center. Or he can contract with a specialist that he wants to send people to. So to me, it's a much simpler, much cleaner. It doesn't incentivize you to over-order tests. It doesn't incentivize you to under-order tests. And it leaves that decision sort of in a neutral place between the doctor and the patient.
Anybody got any questions for Dr. Nicholson? Thanks again for joining us. It certainly put a better perspective on the bill for us. And with that, we're going to go to Charles McKee. And Charles, the bill before us today is the only one we want to stay on, which is 159, House Bill 159. So welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Charles McKee. And I'm pleased to stay with House Bill 159. I also want to point out that AS 45 Section 5-77-020 is what we're dealing with, what I'm testifying before. It's a corporate structure, not the accession of 1959, Alaska. But that being said, I want to bring out the fact that I'm currently under a case, workers' compensation, and dealing with that entity and the insurance company, the employer.
Actually, Charles, that's not the bill before us.
You're talking about, the bill talks about whether you're insured or not. You got to have insurance, and can you contract out? And that's what I'm talking about, is that I'm trying to contract out, and I gave them a contract to be satisfied today. I'm talking about the insurance, I'm talking about the law firm that's representing the attorney.
Thanks again, Charles.
The employer.
With that, we will we're going to close out public testimony, and we're going to bring Lori back up for an insurance presentation. We're holding the bill open. We anticipate that we'll be able to take action on it probably by the end of next week if we get everybody together. And with that, please come back up, Lori.
Brief it easy, sir.
Yeah. Brief it easy. It's 3:20, and with us we have Lori Wanghire, the director of the Division of Insurance. And welcome back again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, where do I begin on healthcare today? Thank you for having me. This meeting was scheduled a week or so ago, and certainly things have changed dramatically in the past few days. But I had started this presentation and wanted to give you an update on healthcare and where we were, and a little bit of background again that, you know, the mission of the division, of course, is to protect consumers. And it appears that the last few days we have been very busy protecting consumers. And some may question why we are doing what we're doing, but that the action we've taken for MOTA, or against MOTA, is exactly to protect consumers in the state of Alaska. The division has a statutory responsibility to review and approve rates, rules, and forms. And we have often looked at rates, and when we look at them, we are to determine if they're excessive, inadequate, or if they're unfairly discriminatory. Mm-hmm. And often when we look at excessive, that does not mean how it impacts your pocketbook or mine, or anyone's budget, particularly small employers in the individual market. But will they support the pool, the individual market, the 22,000 people that are in it, the claims that are presented. Will the rates support those claims? And when you do the simple math, is the rate justified? Of course, the inadequate is almost the opposite, and the unfairly discriminatory is making sure that they're not charging a rate that they would not charge, such as they can discriminate. In the ACA, you can't charge for pre-existing conditions, but you can use a rate difference for someone who is tobacco or some conditions such as that. And just, you know, I'm going to try and get through some of this a little bit quickly because I'm sure you have questions on what the actions we've taken against MOTA in the past few days. But some acronyms are in your handout, just again for your reference, because I know we tend to speak a lot in acronyms. Where we're at in the ACA, and some of this is an update to the presentation I did for this committee about a year and a half ago. The ACA was enacted. President Obama signed it in March 23rd, 2010. If you remember, it was, if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. So we all didn't go to ACA-compliant plans at the same time. And so we still have what we call the grandfathered plans. If you had an insurance product in 2010, those plans are still in what we call the grandfathered plans. In the fall of 2013, there was a decision made that if you had a plan and didn't like what, because, and part of it was because we were having issues with the exchange and accessing ACA compliant plans. There was a decision made that you could keep your plans as long as it was purchased between 2010 and the fall of 2013. You could keep those plans, and we considered them the non-grandfathered plans. And some of those plans still exist, but they will transition out here in the next year. And so then we started the qualified insurance plans as of January 1st, 2014. So right now we're dealing with basically three segments of insurance plans. The grandfathered plans could actually go on forever, but the non-grandfathers should transition out this year. But with all things CMS, there is a rumor that they will allow the small group to extend yet another year before they transition to ACA compliant plans. Even with the rate increases that we have seen, and there's no doubt that they have been high in the time frame of the steps we've taken here with the ACA and the implementation, the Premier took a rate increase of 37.2, MOTA took a rate increase of 27.4% in 2014. In 2015, it was 38.7 and 39.6 for Premera and MOTA, respectively. But that didn't stop us from getting where we're at right now. And again, I think it's important to remember, and I can't tell you how many times I've had to talk about this the past few days, that part of the protection of the consumers is the solvency of the companies. And doing the simple math of the size of the pool, the health of the pool, or in this case perhaps the sickness of the pool, the simple math of going back into what are the rates and what is it going to take to support that pool. The numbers, you can see where we've gone from the numbers as far as we are looking at an increase. There's no doubt we've started to enroll more people. But at this time, we have lost insurance in the marketplace in 2016, and those individuals would have enrolled in beginning January of this year, either in Premera or MOTA. The last count we had, which was about a week ago, it looked like the numbers were pretty well split with Premera and MOTA. MOTA might have had a slight edge on the individual market simply because their rate was a little bit less. Here you can see that in 2015 they had a significant share of the market over Premera, and again it was because of their rate, which even with the rate increases, the health of the pool has led to significant financial distress for them, and the result of the order that was issued this week. Aetna has left the market. Assurant has left the market. Celtic is in the market, but they have not written any business. We did talk to CMS this afternoon, and have asked that we're going to have a joint call with them next week to see what we can do to encourage them to start writing in the market. I don't know where the conversation will lead, but we're hopeful that maybe Celtic will begin to write in the end. Their filing's approved. They just have not been competitive, but with Moda not able to write in the individual or any market for that matter at this particular point, we're hoping that Celtic will begin writing to give us some competition in the individual market. But that remains to be seen. We're also with Aetna, there's some national mergers going on, and we're hopeful that when the mergers are over, that the surviving member of Aetna is part of a merger, that perhaps Aetna can come back in to the market. Mm-hmm. There is a statute that does not allow them right now to come back in for 5 years after they exited the market, but if after the merger they were considering coming back in, I'd be walking through this building and asking every legislature to redo that statute quickly because we need the competition. Mm-hmm. The small group market.
Is that something you can waive without legislation?
I don't know. Representative, or Mr. Chairman, because of what just happened this week, we're looking at it to see if it's something we could do through regulation or what it would take if they were able to come back in, what we could do and how quickly we could do it. It's on our list of things to see what it would take, again, if after the merger, if we could get them back in, what it would take.
You know, the reason I ask is because of the extraordinary conditions that are going on right now. A lot of things are queued up, and it would be faster if you could do it that way. I mean, we can. I'll certainly help you in any way I can, but it would be faster.
I appreciate that because it's absolutely being down to one insurer. We understand there's no options in the individual market, and so we're working as hard as we can to rectify that or to bring entice someone else to come into Alaska. And if Aetna were the answer, then we would be working with whatever it took to get Aetna back in. The small group, again, just the numbers so you can see what we had. And the reason I'm showing you this is because sometimes it when we talk about the claims numbers, and I probably should have stopped at the, if I back up a slide just for a minute, the individual market, at one point we had over 44 million in losses in one market. And if you took that number and divided it by the enrollees, that was over 6,000 per member. Now, if you took, that's per member. So for a family of two, that'd be 12,000. I mean, just simple math. Any way you do this, it's not cheap. And that doesn't allow for the adjudicating of the claims or claims, you know, care management or anything that goes with having a healthcare policy. It's just the simple math of the claims. So there's no easy way to slice and dice this and make it a pretty story. The potential drivers as we look at 2017, and of course a lot of this is based on, this came from a study done by Milliman, and some of this we're certainly recognizing today, and it's healthcare cost and utilization is, you know, a big one. The cost of prescription drugs, there is, you know, healthcare costs were flat for a couple of years, but we're starting to see a trend up. And utilization is absolutely a number one driver. If people are, while they're utilizing healthcare, we want them to utilize it, but they're utilizing it in the wrong way. They're seeking it through ER and not through primary care. Changes to the essential.
You know, I've got a great bill that works. Sorry, go ahead.
No commercials.
Changes to the essential health benefits. There are some changes in the next year, in 2017, to the cost-sharing structure that may impact rates. We're watching to see how that will impact Alaska. We don't, the benchmark plan won't change, so that shouldn't have an impact. We are looking at, you know, additional data we think will make the market a little bit more stable in Alaska, because we'll have actually 3 years now of our own data, of good or bad, it'll be 3 years of our own data to base the rates on. The insurers merging and exiting the markets, that's not a positive, but it's reality. and that's nationwide, not just in Alaska. Aetna, as you know, left Alaska. Assurant left the marketplace, period. Aetna is going through a merger with Humana, Cigna with Anthem. We'll have to see where those end up. Again, as we talked about a minute ago, I'm hoping that when those are done, perhaps we can attract them back to the Alaska market. But that's kind of a wait and see. United Healthcare is making noise about leaving the individual market. While they don't write up here now, we were in discussions with them, preliminary, about possibly coming back to Alaska to write in the individual market. The continued migrations, that bullet, which I skipped over, is getting the non-grandfathered plans into the individual market. It will strengthen the market, the individual market, a little bit, but there's not that many in the non-grandfathered market at that point. It's not going to make a huge difference, but it will make a little bit of a difference. Ongoing uncertainty in the court cases, it never ends that someone is challenging the Affordable Care Act, and that will remain, and of course, the upcoming elections. The three R's, which I've got further back in another slide to talk about, the reinsurance, the risk corridor, and the risk adjustment, will have an impact in 2017. And then changes in fees and taxes on the Affordable Care Act. Those are all things that will impact Alaska, will impact every state in 2017, some in a positive way and some in a negative way. Us? Well, being down to one healthcare, and you know, I was part of a press conference today, and even with one provider, we're still, and as we're required to by statute, and as we would anyway, we'll still apply the same parameters to any rate filing we receive. But the cost of healthcare is amongst the highest in the nation, and that will be taken into account when we look at what our rates are going to be in 2017. There's limited providers. We have challenges here with the provider networks because so many of our citizens or our constituents are rural. So it's hard to have a network in rural Alaska, and the cost to bring people in from rural Alaska for treatment is high. Even from areas you wouldn't necessarily consider rural, there's a cost to seeking health care in Alaska. The individual.
Ms. Winger, can I just get some basic facts here? Looking at the timeline, this is apropos of this slide 10. You have rate increases last year of 38% and 39%. What is the national average for individual marketplace insurance? Do you know?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I will get it to you and get back.
Okay.
I might add that I passed out the University of Oregon workers' comp comparison of five states and Medicaid, so I think the members have a real grasp on the disparity between Alaska and everybody else in the world, basically. And I think we can make that available to anybody else that would care to have it.
Thank you.
If you call the office, we can email it to you, or we can post it on the Labor and Commerce site. But it's really profound.
It is. Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up, and then Representative Hughes.
Ms. Winhard, do you know what the roughly what an Alaskan in the individual marketplace is spending? Any way to know?
Through the chair, Representative Josephine. It's hard to say because of the premium tax credits and because there are so many plans available. I mean, as of 2 days ago, we had two insurers. You have the three tiers. There's multiple plans within the tier. They're all priced differently. There's three regions within the state. But there are plans that are up as high as $1,800 a month per person. And there are plans that are as low as $500 a month per person. So depending on your age, where you're located, the plans, there's a vary. We do have some data that I believe I can send you.
That's
to show that
the subsidy, though.
Pardon?
That's
before a subsidy. Absolutely, before a subsidy. To get back to your original question, what I can tell you was that in 2014 when we did the, or 2015 when we did the rate increase, we were without a doubt not a source of pride, but we led the pack in rate increases. In 2015 when we did the 2016 rate increase, other states were sharing the pain with us as far as rate increases. We were still amongst the highest, but there were many states that had rate increases of 25, 30, 35%. as they looked at their results of 14 and 15 and recognized that their rates needed serious adjustment to keep the carrier solvent.
Okay. Thank you.
I thought there was another question. I'm sorry.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The title of the slide, Alaska Potential Cost Drivers, refers to the cost of health insurance, but these things seem to, it also could be a title for just the cost of health care in general. But I'm looking at the second bullet in particular, the number of providers, and I'm wondering if you've tracked the number of providers in Alaska and how that compares with the rates going up. And we heard earlier in this committee Mr. Truitt talking about the primary care providers, the ratio of those going down. And my understanding is if you increase the ratio of primary care providers to the population, that would help with health care costs and health insurance rates. And just wondering if you would agree with that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there is a shortage of primary care physicians. We recognize that, and I think you would get the insurance companies to tell you that's often why people go to the emergency room, because they don't have a primary care physician and they can't get into a primary care physician, that there's limited availability of primary care in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
The individual market in Alaska seems to be settling out somewhere between 20 and 22,000, and that may be the number that we settle at. And so that gives us kind of, you know, as we watch the market grow, that may be the number where we're at to know what the size of our pool is, that it may shrink a little or grow a little depending on the economics of Alaska, but it gives us a number to work with so that are we expecting any more growth or not? I don't think so. For the past 3 years, that kind of seems to be where we're at. So I think that, you know, as we look at statistics, it seems to be that that's a number. And good or bad, it's a stable number. We still have adverse loss experience. It's not a healthy pool. And with the premiums the way they are, the ones that are buying insurance are the people that need it. And the ones that are right now not buying insurance and paying the penalty to the IRS are the healthy ones. Mm-hmm. Somehow we need to get those to buy insurance too, and we're struggling with that because of the premiums.
Representative Hito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think if we look back pre-ACA, did we anticipate? I seem to recall a number of somewhere around 27,000 was the anticipated. Do we still think that there's that many uninsured, and that's the healthy population, that 22 to 28,000?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, I would think right now that probably 27, there's probably 5 or 6,000 that we're not getting to.
Thank you.
And just to follow up, the national cost drivers, they do impact Alaska to some degree. The ones we talked about before, the taxes, the what's going on in Washington, D.C. and such, they do impact Alaska. But, of course, you know, what impacts us most is what's going on in Alaska. Looking forward, CMS for 2017 has issued over 100 revisions to the plan. Some of it is not going to necessarily impact cost, but it is things such as out-of-pocket, filing data for on and off, uniform modifications and recertifications, riders as opposed to uniform modifications, network adequacy, the certification process, all things that we have to take into account in the division and make sure we're compliant and that the policies that the insurers are issuing are compliant with. So 100 revisions is a lot for, but it's an evolving act. And as the act gets older, they are making corrections or amendments to it. Again, the medical trends are increasing, the reinsurance and the risk corridor, which again I think is one more slide back or two. The transitional and the non-grandfathered plans will enter the market, which will increase enrollees. And the mergers and acquisitions will tighten the market. But again, I'm hoping that when those mergers are done, that we can have some honest conversations with the surviving insurer and possibly entice them to come and make a filing in Alaska and actively pursue new business, particularly the individual market, and perhaps go on to the exchange.
Representative Hughes?
That second bullet, medical trends increasing at 10% or more, what does that mean, medical trends?
Costs. Oh, through the chair, Representative Hughes, the cost of medical. Okay. For the past few years, it's remained relatively flat, and now it's starting to uptick. And, of course, medical insurance, or the cost of health care insurance, is based on the cost. It boils down to what are you paying for the services you receive. And since it is now ticking up, we're not going to be immune from seeing that in the premiums we pay, not just in the ACA market, but overall.
Okay, thank you.
Does that include prescription drugs?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The next slide, slide 12, for the risk corridor. We've probably talked about this before when we met some time ago. The risk, or the three R's is how the slide's entitled. There's the risk adjustment, the reinsurance, and the risk corridor. And if you do this long enough, you hear us talk the three R's, the three R's, the three R's. And the risk adjustment is a mechanism. Well, let me back up just a minute. These were meant to stabilize the market between all insurers as the ACA came about, the advent of the ACA, and everybody rushed to enter the market, and nobody could quite predict how the losses were going to be. So when Congress passed the law, they came up with these three mechanisms that were the impact was going to be, we'll stabilize the market so it will be healthy till we can get some experience and see exactly where this is going to go. And risk adjustment was basically supposed to be that those that had the bad losses would receive money from those that had the good losses. So at the year end, based on the codes of who had the losses, and then we're not talking profit, we're talking claims, would cut it, those that didn't have would cut a check to the other insurance companies. Well, what's happened is it's working backwards. And financially, an insurance company like Moda is ending up cutting a check to an insurance company like Primera. So it's not, it's like backwards Robin Hood is how it's being referred to in the press. But it was intended to stabilize the market, so if one insurance company had a lesser rate and people flocked to it, and consequently it ended up with significant losses, the insurance company over here would end up helping to subsidize that company. Well, in the way it's ended up with as almost a backwards Robin Hood effect. And it's under some scrutiny, and if you read the trades, they're looking at making adjustments to the risk adjustment and how it functions. It is the only one of the three R's that is intended to go beyond 2016. Reinsurance. Typical insurance beyond the insurance itself. And it was a three-year program. It sunsets this year, so the insurance companies will have to buy commercial reinsurance themselves. It potentially will have an impact on rates. And the risk corridor. This program was insurance companies that had profits. The federal government would basically clawbacker, it would take a certain percentage of the profits, and the insurance companies that had losses would receive money back, again, to stabilize the market for the first 3 years until we could see how this played out. Well, what happened was that the losses were significant, and the money they took back did not stabilize. There wasn't enough to pay what was anticipated. And what they got so far for the 2014 year is 12.6% on the dollar. And so it has had some upheaval with insurance companies.
Representative Josephson.
So in effect, 12.6 is sort of their profit, if you will.
12.6, through the chair, Representative Josephson, insurance companies were expecting, let's say, 100% of $50 million from the federal government through this program. They got 12.6% of $50 million.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're just in the adjustment. There wasn't enough to work the way it was intended.
Okay.
And that was a nationwide.
This is what happens when you have non-insurance people putting together insurance products. It's happened before in different under different circumstances, but somebody gets what appears to be a good idea, and it hasn't been fleshed out completely.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I thought you were talking about the feature where they couldn't retain more than 20% of the total. That
through the chair, I think you're speaking, Representative Josem, about the medical loss ratio.
Right. Yes.
Things we could do. In 2017, states are allowed to file for what is called the Section 1332 Innovation Waiver, and that's a big step. I mean, that's a huge step, a scary step. Colorado, Minnesota, Hawaii, and Massachusetts are looking at it. Vermont had kind of tried it and failed. And what it is that you basically take the ACA and say you can run it as a state better by yourself rather than participate as an ACA at the federal level. And it takes the legislative approval to do it, and you're subject to CMS approval after the legislature.
And if I may, on this
follow
one, that what you're speaking of here, Ms. Winghart, is more than just the state taking control of the individual market. It's the whole shoot and match. It's sort of taking the entire bill?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And this slide is, in essence, what you have to give you some bullet points of what you have to do. You have to have comprehensive coverage, at least as broad as the ACA, the same out-of-pocket. You cannot increase the federal deficit. You have to submit business. So you're taking a risk that if we fail, the state would be taking on the obligation. It's a big undertaking.
Well, if you went in that direction, how many people would you have to add? I don't believe you could do it with existing staff, could you?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, no, we could not. There would have to be, I believe, that we would have to set up something similar to almost like the Permanent Fund Corporation, something outside the state.
Standalone?
Run. Oh, a separate.
Okay, like MICA.
Yes. Yes, sir. But you would get the money that's being paid out in premium tax credits, we would get as almost a block grant, and then we could disperse back to citizens for premium tax credits based on the premiums we were charging. You could bring in other programs, such as the state program. I mean, there's things you could do, but it's being tested in other states. It's just a big undertaking of how successful they will be or not to see if it works. And we are watching to see how other states do. Vermont did not do well. And we're looking to see how Hawaii, Colorado, and the other states do. But again, they cannot do it until January 17th at the very earliest.
I thought Hawaii folded a couple weeks ago.
Mr. Chairman, Hawaii's exchange folded, but they are still pursuing a 1332 waiver.
Representative Ledoux.
So if the state did something like this, how much would it likely cost the state to do? Not just in the additional people, but the state would be basically acting like an insurance company, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we have not gotten that far to even think about pricing, how much it would be, because I think it would have to be a standalone entity.
Follow?
So I guess I'm just thinking that if people who are in the business of insurance are having problems remaining solvent in this state, that the likelihood that the state could do it without a significant financial drain is probably somewhat unlikely.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there would have to be some backing somewhere, and based on the losses that we know of, it would be a gamble if it could be successful. I'm not saying it's not worth looking at, because again, at this point in time, there's no idea we should not be exploring. But on the 22,000 that are in the individual market, I don't know at this point what we know about that pool that we would want to do it on that. If we were looking at bringing in all the state employees, per se, let's just as an example, then it's a bigger pool, and you've got numbers to work with. But somehow you've got to get the numbers up. So it's what numbers do you use? Who are you bringing in to make it work? Do you open it up to what groups to make it work? Who are you picking? Not-for-profits, this group, that. I mean, it's just, it's all in the planning of how would you use this Section 1332 waiver, and who would you open it up to, and who's going to administer it, and how does it pay for itself? And that's the question of how would it work.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson?
Sure. So Ms. Winghart, there's 730,000 Alaskans, give or take. We've added 22,000 in the individual market, about 20,000 in Medicaid expansion, I think. People have IHS, they have their employer's coverage, their public employees. Who's left? How many are not insured now?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when we look at what we know of insured, we have about 16% of the population, because you're going to take out all federal employees, because I would assume they're not going to join. Mm-hmm. You're probably not going to get, as you say, the IHS. You're not probably going to get Medicaid, Medicare. So it's not a big number. We just don't know if the number's big enough to make it work. But we are watching what other states do, because in some respects they have to be facing the same obstacles that we are. Colorado has it on the ballot right now as an initiative. Minnesota is pursuing it. Hawaii, and Hawaii's demographics in some ways, in some respects, are not that much different than ours. So we're watching, but we don't want to come forward with an idea that we don't know has been tried. Other solutions. We have talked about regional exchanges, but right now you can't sell across state lines. Mm-hmm. If we could, then there might be an opportunity to do an exchange or do something with, let's say, the Pacific Northwest. We have looked at combining the small and individual group to spread the risk amongst both. But in all honesty, that's not going to make your small group constituents happy.
Representative Kudo.
Thank you. On the regional exchanges, and I think we had talked briefly about that, but one of the thoughts is it sounded like it was more of an insurance limitation as opposed to an ACA limitation. Have any other states or regions started talking about selling product across state lines?
Through the chair, Representative Kudo, it's talked about a lot amongst the NEIC commissioners, particularly those of us with small states.
Okay, thank you.
If we could combine.
Representative Hughes.
And maybe I missed this, but in order to do that, would it, each of the states that would want to be in exchange, would we have to pass state laws to allow that, or is that a federal law that's not allowing us to cross state lines?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
Lori, before we run out of time, could you address the impact on state employees with MOTA?
Mr. Chairman, state employees are not impacted by the MOTA decision. The MOTA, the card says MOTA, and it's the dental plan, but it's actually Oregon Dental, and it's under the same parent, but it is not MOTA Health Plan, Inc. That the order has been issued against.
You might want to put an email out to them. I've had a number of calls, and I would suspect other people in the room have. I knew the answer before I asked the question, but I think if you could put something out to all of them, it would probably put people at ease that have two MOTA cards in their wallet, like probably a lot of people in the room.
I will check and make sure I will get that out.
After,
I know that
after tonight's news, we'll probably all be getting calls on our cell phones. Representative Hughes.
I have the million-dollar question for you. Are you ready? If you were queen for a day, what would you do? What do you think we could do here in Alaska to bring our health care insurance rates and health care costs down and then even apply that nationally, what you think might be a way to address the challenges of rising costs?
Through the chair, that's a big question. I think we you don't ever want to see anybody be you want everybody to come to the table, and you don't want to have the losers. You want everybody to come to the table and think that they walked away a winner. And we get a lot of calls from all sides, the insurers, the agents and brokers, the providers, and certainly the medical, you know, the medical community. And I think that sometimes the missing piece we have is with the medical community. We see the disparity amongst the rates, and yet we can't always justify it. I don't want to see the medical community go away. We're very proud of our medical community, and I've been here long enough to remember when we didn't have much of a medical community, even in Anchorage. But the disparity, I think the numbers speak for themselves. And somehow we've got to get to a point where why is it costing 5, 6, 7 times as much for a procedure in Anchorage as it is in Seattle? Why are employers now flying employees out to have a procedure done? Because it's cheaper to fly the employee and a companion to Seattle or Portland than have it done in Anchorage. And I think somehow we have got to get the providers to the table and recognize, and I don't necessarily mean the small clinics that are, you know, the one man, one woman specialist or, you know, provider, but the large clinics and hospitals and such, because the costs are just, they're driving up the cost of health care to the point that people cannot afford it. And when we get a filing, we know that the insurance carriers have negotiated rates, and we trust they've done their best. And I don't doubt that they have, but what I don't know is why the provider, the hospital or the clinic, needs that much for that particular procedure, mm-hmm. and why it costs so much for them as opposed to Seattle or Portland or Colorado or wherever. And I think that's the missing piece of the puzzle.
Actually, the answer to that was in some Department of Labor testimony a year or two ago, and that was on the difference on emergency flights, you know, the medevacs, and something that might cost $25,000 would cost the insurance companies $120,000, and they justified by saying, well, somebody has to pay, and what they meant is somebody has to pick up the difference between what Medicaid will pay and what their costs are, and so somebody has to pay as the insurance companies. And it's not illegal, I might add. What's saying to do?
But it's not just in the air ambulances.
Oh, no,
it's in various procedures. Mm-hmm.
But that one is big. It's like $120,000, $125,000 from the North Slope for a injured worker, and it might be $20,000 for a Medicaid flight, Medicaid medevac flight. So I mean, the disparity is, you know, $100,000, for example.
It's also very hard for the consumer. It's certainly not like a restaurant where you know what the charge is. I think we've all faced that. And often providers who I think are good people are sort of surprised when you ask, well, what is the rate? Yeah, it's hard to get a concrete answer. So.
Well, do you think we might be able to get you back in like 2 weeks for another update, maybe just for 15, 20 minutes?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe a half hour if you have a lot of questions. But I think by then this thing will be... This particular problem will be evolving, and number one, you might have more information, and number two, we might have more questions.
Certainly.
And again, I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and I and for taking a lot of time out of what is probably one of your busier days of the year. And how late are you going to be working tonight?
I was hoping to catch the plane home tonight, but I'm here for the session, so I'm back Sunday night or Monday morning, so I can be here whenever you want.
Yeah, it'll be in a couple of weeks, unless something really takes a turn one way or another. But thanks again, and good luck.
Thank you.
And with that, we adjourn at 5 o'clock.